Hi, everyone. This is Catherine Adams.
And Elizabeth Wallace. And you're listening to Binary System Podcast number 442. And once again this week, we are going to do some recaps of the things we've been watching. Catherine watched an episode of Beastars, but I didn't. So we're going to save a discussion for the latest episode you watched for next week, I think.
Right. If you thought the whole concept of a chicken, a sentient chicken selling her eggs for people to eat in the first season was weird, shit gets even weirder.
Oh, boy. Now, we also watched another episode of Arcane, the second-to-last episode of Arcane.
Right.
And Catherine saw the second-to-last episode of the second season of Lower Decks, which I think was probably one of my favorite episodes of the whole series, to be honest.
It's definitely been my favorite of this entire season. Yeah. It was just that fun.
So we'll start out with Arcane because it's kind of dark. So we can end on with a lighter note with Lord X. Yay.
And we got a little bit more backstory now. We finally found out what happened to Mel after she'd been captured. And then they revealed that her brother was really someone they were just pretending to be her brother so they could get answers out of her. And then she got surrounded by all these chains, and then there was this huge explosion as her eyes started glowing. And now we find out, I'm fairly sure that her mother had an affair with somebody from the Black Rose, whoever they are, and Mel is the daughter. So she now has the same kind of powers, and they're reaching out to her because her mother has been lying about her and to her this entire time about who she is.
Yeah, and the Black Rose reaches out to her in the form of a shapeshifter, I suppose, and at one point is even talking to her in her own form, if I want to say, and then also appearing as her mother as well. So I guess, is that something that all of the Black Rose can do?
I don't know. I did recognize one of the people that it pretended to be, or it took the shape of, that flashback that Mel had when her mother had defeated this one kingdom, and Mel was coming up with all these plans on how to set up the throne room to be able to reach out to the populace, and her mother has them bring in one last surviving member of the royalty, and it was this person, you know, with the decorative chains all over her face. And her mother killed the girl in front of Mel to try to tell her, you have to do the difficult thing. But yeah, so they let her go, which is the thing. They weren't actually, I think they were looking to find her, but they weren't looking to take advantage of her, I don't think. But I'm still not clear about whether they did or did not kill her brother while they were thinking that he might have been the secret child.
Yeah, because Mel even asks her mother later exactly what happened to her brother, and the answer is still not clear after her mother answers, I don't think. Just basically, I think that her mother had hoped that her brother was going to be the one that they were waiting for, but it wasn't. It was actually Mel.
Uh-huh. And Mel asked her, did you let him die? Because he'd been taken prisoner. And Ambessa just clocks her across the face. She can't believe she asked that. I don't think she actually says no, though.
Yeah. Now, while all this is going on, so Ambessa she's actually sort of mourning that first in command, big, huge, big guy who got killed a couple episodes, I suppose. And she goes to the doctor and she's telling the doctor that she wants him to give what he's been promising her because he's been saying that he can defeat death. And so what he does is does he use part of her first in command or just Vi and Jinx's dad
for Vander?
Part of the little
I think it's mostly Jinx and Vi's dad, because when they're starting up this whole thing, you see this creature that Vander turned into, and you look inside his head basically, and he's remembering all of, you know, his children that he adopted and himself, and it's in these beautiful watercolor images, and they're all getting burned away. But that comes up later, because one of the things that happens first is that Mel goes to see Jace, and Jace is in the conference room, and he's looking down at the conference table, which has been repaired, but it's got that sort of, you know, that Japanese art style where you fix a shattered piece of porcelain, but you put gold in the seams. And I'm just looking at it going, why are some of the chairs and the seating areas in front of them not damaged? And Mel shows up, and Jay sees that she's, you know, got, you know, because she's covered with so much more of that gold stuff that she had in her face, but it's now everywhere, and he can tell that she's different. And he looked at her, and he said, "You're the reason we weren't killed in that attack." And I'm like, that's that's it. Yes, because when we saw that missile heading to them, it was headed right for Mel, and I had no idea how she managed to survive. Well, now apparently we do.
Yes, we do, because I'm not even sure. I mean, can you explain to me, like I'm a child, exactly what Mel is?
She's like a race of mages, I think. And she's just one of those people that is born with this kind of magical ability that Jace and all the people who have been using Hextech have to try to like harness through technology. But she's different now. And I think he was horrified of her because, of course, he's seen what happens with Hextech in Piltover. But I do think they reach some kind of, I don't know, they reach some kind of understanding because he apologizes to her and he says, you know, I hadn't realized that you were probably suffering through all of this as well. And she was just like, I don't even know who I am anymore. And she's just like going to be this bystander in her mother's quest to. And I'm still a little unsure about what M'Bessa wants, because I thought that she was looking for weaponry that would help her with the fight against her enemies, in this case, the Black Rose. But it also seems like she can't abide the fact that Piltover has all this power that her kind and her people don't. So that's, I mean, and if she has to destroy Piltover to get it or to keep them from using it against her, she's fine with that.
Yeah, I read a recap of this that said something like, war is just the Noxian way. That's always going to be what she defaults to every single time. Now, lest we forget, we've also got what's going on with Vi. And, you know, they had had the explosion and Vander's death and everything. She wakes up. Now, she had been unconscious when they had actually arrested Jinx. And they threw Jinx into prison. And she does manage to sneak in there to see her. And you see Jinx just sort of crouched against the ground. And it's really heartbreaking. For one, her hair is all down. And it's just because her hair is so long. You know, this like stupidly long braids of hers. Well, it's just in this curtain around her. It's just all this like scraggly blue hair. But you also see her. She's talking. And she's like picking at her fingers with her nails and making them bleed and everything. And just, she's given up. She is absolutely, because she's so distraught over Aisha's death. And it's just, it's really, it was really, really well done. But Vi can't really reach her.
No, and she also has been talking to Silco in her head, the shade of Silco or whatever it is that she imagines that he's there. He's not telling her anything that's helpful. Vi isn't telling her anything that's helpful. Jinx even talks to Caitlin at one point when Caitlin comes in. Jinx tells her, if you're going to kill me, just go ahead and do it. And Caitlin's like, I've hated you and I just can't do this anymore. And she's like, she can't get Jinx to come up to face her, to talk, to snap out of it somehow. And she starts to walk away. And Jinx says, I didn't know she was there, your mother. It probably wouldn't have made a difference, but I didn't know she was there.
Yeah.
It's the closest we're going to get to an apology. And it's way more than Jinx has been willing to give in the past, I think.
Anyway, a little while later, Vi comes and manages to get away. She gets the key from somebody to let Jinx out of the cage because she thinks, okay, so basically what's about to happen is there's going to be war in Piltover, and there are a lot of stirring speeches from a lot of people about how everybody needs to come together. And this is the thing that actually, like, unites Zaun and the rest of Piltover, the idea of just protecting their own. You see people leaving to get out of the city. You see some people who leave, but then they change their mind and they come back because they're going to stay and fight. It's very, very lots of stirring stuff and everything. And Vi thinks that if Jinx helps with this, she can clear her name. Because, you know, already Jinx is, you know, a hero in the underworld and everything. This could clear her name in the overworld if she keeps on helping. Jinx kind of does a little bit of a bait and switch, though.
Yep. She manages to get Vi locked in the cage instead of her. And she is telling her, you don't have to worry about me anymore. She is just, she is stepping away. She is like, that was one thing that Selko had said about conflict and how it only ends when somebody has the strength to walk away. And Jinx says that's what she's going to do. And it's like, and Vi is just, is just distraught because she's now trusted somebody again and it's gone wrong. And she's just like punching the wall. She's furious that once again she has made the wrong decision.
And then Caitlin shows up, and Caitlin lets Vi know that she actually left the cage unguarded because she knew that Vi was going to actually try to let Jinx out, and Caitlin was okay with that, and Vi realizes that Caitlin's okay with that.
And they start kissing, and we have a whole love scene, and it's great.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, goodness gracious.
It's beautiful. I mean, at one point, Caitlin just gently pushes her away and says, I have to tell you something. While you were away, I was with somebody, and Vi says, Caitlin, I don't fucking care. I mean, I love when they manage to make things that look, it's not deliberately cinematic, the sort of thing, like love scene. It just, you know, like at one point, Vi's trying to get Caitlin's pants unbuckled, and she's got a complicated buckle on that uniform of hers, and the two of them start giggling, and it's just, oh, it's so cute.
It was cute. It was sexy, but it was
really
cute.
Sexy,
it was
really sexy, yeah.
Yeah, and it's so nice, because in so many TV shows and movies and everything, they do that thing where they're just, it's queer baiting, and they just say, oh, maybe it's going to happen, maybe it's not going to happen. It's really nice. It's like, no, they're gay, and they're having sex. It's amazing.
Yeah, the whole queer baiting thing, I understand, is a way to try to appeal to the population of people who want that, but then never actually committing to it because they don't want to tick off the people who think that's bad. So it's just like, if you see that, shake your finger at them, because that's kind of like a silly way of doing things.
Yes, and mean too. Gosh, it's just such a tease.
And it happens so often.
Yeah, it really does. So when we had talked about how the doctor was using a bit of Vander for this thing that he was going to do, what he was doing was he was kind of doing something that was channeling the energy through Vander and through a lot of Victor's, like all of his people who have collapsed on the ground when Jace hit him with the blast and everything. But now they all just kind of rise up into the air, and Victor is speaking through all of them to M'Bessa.
Yep. And he and the doctor are doing what M'Bessa wants at this point, which is to create an army that can't die. Mm-hmm. But first thing he wants to do is he needs to talk with Jace and try to somehow manage to get Jace to work with him on this project. And he does it in the form of this robotic thing that's all white with gold trim and everything, and very, very intimidating, and just kind of floats his way into the council room where Mel and Jace are talking. And they're not having any of it, and there's a fight going on. And it's beautiful, it's violent. It's terrifying, and Mel doesn't quite know how to control her powers, but it's pretty much the only thing that keeps Victor, or the form that he's in, from killing Jace at this point. And it just, they somehow manage to get the upper hand and get the robot, whatever it is. And that's when Victor tells Doctor that he can just go ahead with the second part of his project. And that's he starts turning all of his people into those floating robot things. And I'm pretty sure those were the zombie things in when Jace went to the apocalypse, and all those things that were just kind of frozen in place until they start walking. Yeah, that's what this is. So all of those people that put all their trust into Victor, but he's like, you know, when you see him, he's still in that sort of astral realm where his, you know, his hair is glowing white and everything. And when he tells the doctor to proceed, his assistant is still there, and she tells him goodbye, which he knew was coming. And he really appreciated that she's been there for him as his companion. And he says, I will miss our talks. And she looks at him and she says, no, you won't. So I think whatever happens when Vander's body gets like transformed and you see all of his memories burning away, somehow Victor is getting absorbed into that. And I think both of them are now gone. At least that was my implication.
I wasn't sure if he would be like gone or not, because we still have one more episode left, and I can't imagine him not being there for the final episode, but maybe there's a piece of him left. I don't know.
But,
yeah. I can't tell you how pretty it all is.
It's so pretty. Every bit of it.
I was talking with our friend Wade, and he had watched a few episodes of Arcane, maybe even just like one and a half, but he couldn't get past the animation. He thought that the characters and the faces and the mouths and everything were very soulless, like a video game and everything. And I'm like, I don't know if I've gotten used to the animation style over the past 19 or so episodes and everything, or if they've gotten better, because I told him about the bit with Echo and the episode 7 where Echo was smiling at her, and it wasn't just a smile. It was a smile with all of this like bittersweet regret, but vague happiness and everything. And I'm just like, it was subtle. It was good. It was not soulless. So I don't know if it's gotten better or if I've become accustomed to it, but man, it's not soulless.
I think that first scene in the first episode where Vi and Powder are there and they're both children and, you know, they see their parents off the side of this battleground and the parents have obviously died in the fight. And just the look on Vi's face when she just takes a breath and she like takes another breath and then she starts crying and she's trying to not cry. And it's just like, it was so powerful. And I think maybe if some of the expressions are a little bit, you know, static sometimes or once in a while, like they don't want to move the mouths too much, I'm still just giving it so much credit just because of that. But I mean, it's not always like that. Because you remember in the first episode with, oh God, it was Mel going to confront her mother when her mother's boy toy was there. And she smacks the wine goblet out of the way. And then she tells him, leave, like that. And it's just, her expression was so powerful and like rage and teeth bared and everything. And then the little boy toy is like looking up at Embessa and his whole expression is like, really?
There was so much going on. I really like that. Because the mother is sort of like looks over at Mel and just like gives him just like a little wave with the hand. Like, yeah, yeah, head out and everything. And I just loved all of it. Yeah, there's a lot of, they don't have to like explain every single thing. We don't have to have dialogue. They do rely on expressions a bunch of the time.
They really do. So yeah. Mm-hmm. I checked and the next episode is going to be the longest one of the season. I think it's like 50 minutes. So I don't know if we want to commit to doing that this week or try to give us another week off or something. I don't know. So focus on Lower Decks and Beastars or something. I don't know.
Something. I don't know. Oh my God. It's not even that I want to focus on it. I could watch it right now. I don't want it to end and I want to eke it out a little bit longer. Mm-hmm.
Me too. So for something a little bit more lighthearted, a lot more lighthearted.
Wow, yeah, seriously.
The second to last episode of Lower Decks for season 2, I can't remember the title because I think when the title card came up in the episode, it was either written in Vulcan or in Klingon. Mm. So what's happened is that the Cerritos is heading to another part of space, and it's like a long warp, which means it's going to be at least 12 hours where they're doing nothing but traveling. And since there's nothing in this part of space, the captain's given everybody the day off. So everybody's like hanging out and doing their own thing, which is great because you get to see like Rutherford is with the chief of security, a whole bunch of other people doing pottery with their pottery wheels, that sort of thing. And Tendi is with the doctor and they're doing rock climbing. And poor Mariner has been roped in by her mother to do a lot of mother-daughter things. But it's all so fun. And then you've got poor Boimler. He wants to be buddies with somebody up in the command crew, like everybody else is, but he can't manage it because he's just so eager. But what just makes this episode sublime is the fact that we also see the lower deck crews of a Klingon ship and a Vulcan ship. And oh my God, it's wonderful because you follow the eager beaver person from each crew as they try to navigate whatever it is they're dealing with. But eager beaver looks so different in each one of these crews.
Yes, because in the Vulcan side, you've got this young Vulcan officer and she's getting reprimanded because she followed an instinct at one point, and you don't do that. Like, follow a hunch as a Vulcan, you never do that. It's always logic, always logic. And in her own way, she's being very snarky at people about it.
Oh, she is. Yeah. I mean, she talks about how she feels that it would be a better choice to do something like this, and everyone, you know, it's like a raised eyebrow is the reaction you get, which is pretty severe for a Vulcan. But she talks to her commanding officer and saying that they need to check out this one anomaly because she has a hunch that it's possibly something that concerns them. And he decides to. And you see that she smiles, but it's just like one corner of her mouth smiles. And then he says, do not take this as some kind of acceptance of your behavior, and tells her that she's going to have to go do 2 days of meditation. And she doesn't think that that's really warranted. And he said, this outburst is why it's warranted, because you are acting like a child. And it just, so I guess so. On any other crew, she would be like shouting at people and sassing off and just being so insubordinate. But it's a Vulcan, so nobody raises their voices.
Nope, not even once. Now, meanwhile, back over on the Cerritos, one of the things that Boimler has done is he's actually trying now. He was trying to just bond with anybody from the bridge crew, like the main bridge crew, but he's not making it work. But it's Ransom, mm-hmm. I guess it is. He finds out that Ransom is from Hawaii. He overhears something about it and everything. And so he decides to pretend that he's from Hawaii as well. Except it turns out Ransom hangs out with a bunch of people and they're all from Hawaii. And Boimler is so out of his depth. But however, they don't really pick up on the fact that he's lying. I feel like if they were a little smarter, they would have figured it out. But everybody just sort of welcomes him in to do Hawaii type stuff.
But we find out when they get into like the ship gets into a conflict and they all have to make a run for it, and somehow Boimler blurts out that he's not from Hawaii, but he just wanted to feel like he belonged. And all of the other three, you know, people who were bonding with Ransom, they're also not from Hawaii. They just heard Ransom say he was, and they wanted to feel like they belonged. And Ransom says, well, I've got to confess that I'm not from Hawaii, because my commanding officer said he was from Hawaii, so I pretended I was, and I've had to keep the lie going on the entire time. And they're all from different moons, and now they're bonding about the fact that they're all like moon dwellers. And Boimler tries to get on it, but he's from, what, California, I think?
I think so. Somewhere on Earth.
Of course, they get so offended. So, of course, it doesn't work because it's Boimler.
Yes, exactly. You thought for a minute they were all going to bond over the fact that they weren't actually from Hawaii. They were all pretending, and that was going to be a bonding thing. But then the moon thing came up, and Boimler was like, oh, God.
Now, the third crew that we're dealing with is the Klingon crew. And the Eager Beaver Klingon is trying to become the next officer, like the second in command, because the previous one got stabbed, which usually happens. And he's actually managing to bond with the commanding officer. He takes his like hulking dog for a walk or something, and then manages to bond with him about really wanting to bring back the glory of Klingon, because they can't believe that there are people, there are Klingons that are serving on Starfleet ships. But it turns out the commanding officer has been working with, what are the names?
Paklids.
Which are those incredibly stupid aliens are always trying to get into some kind of conflict so they can get power. And he's been encouraging, like providing them with weapons so that they can attack Starfleet, which the Lower Decks Klingon is like, but Klingons don't make other people fight their battles. And he does eventually end up getting into a knockdown, drag-out fight with this guy, because he will not condone firing on another ship when it's not even their fight. And they were the ones that started this by encouraging the Paklids to attack. And then he ends up getting command of the ship and taking the ship back to the Klingon homeworld. I'm like, that's good for you. He comes out the best of all three ships, I think.
It was great because it's like, you know, Klingons, bad guys and weird and everything. But what he was talking about, what this captain was doing with the Paklids and everything, it was so dishonorable and it was underhanded. And it's not something that Klingons would do. And I love it when writers can like establish how the rules for a race work and make it kind of just like the whole thing was very logical and all made sense. You know, it's not like he was like, I don't know. It's not like he was trying to like be the good guy. He was trying to do what Klingons do, and they don't do the shit that the captain was doing. And I thought that was really nicely done.
But the reason why there's this conflict is that the Cerritos sees the Paklid ship with the Klingons, and then the Paklids start firing on them. So they're all having to fight. And of course, everybody's wearing their dress down stuff, like their exercise gear. And there was somebody, like some dude in the hallway that was wearing some kind of Renaissance dress, whatever. And nobody's commenting on it. So it's just everybody's in their vacation wear, and they're in the middle of a fight, and it's getting pretty bad, and their ships are getting knocked down, and then at the last second, the Vulcan ship jumps in between them and the Paklids, and I'm just like cheering. Oh my God, that's one of the reasons why it's my favorite episode, because I love that sort of thing. They were just right there when they needed, because the little Eager Beaver Vulcan managed to convince them to come to investigate the anomaly, and the project that she had been working on, even when she was supposed to be meditating, was a way to boost used the shields. And so she freaking saved the day. And the whole time that the Packlets are fighting, you hear their alarm going on in the background. And it's like, I think instead of red alarm, isn't it, what is it, warm alarm, I think, or something?
I think so.
Yeah,
something
but it's in the Packlet, like, deliberately stupid sounding voice, sounding like it's whining. So it's like, warm alarm, warm alarm.
I forget the name. I was listening to a podcast recently. Oh, shoot. It was okay. It was all right. I know it has some fans. I'm sure it's great. I'll look up the name of it and everything. But yeah, one of the things they have on their ship, too, there's an alarm every once in a while. It goes on in the guy's voice. Alarm. Alarm. I thought about that when I saw that. Oh, but it was the most triumphant moment when the ship came in. Plus, the design on the Vulcan ship is pretty freaking cool.
I really liked it. I've been looking on Reddit every once in a while with people talking about the Lower Decks show, and everyone's really impressed when they come up with other designs for ships that aren't like the Enterprise model sort of thing, or especially the Hesperions, who are not Starfleet, and I don't think they're part of Starfleet or anything like that. So they just have their own planet's ship design. And it's just like, it's wonderful getting to see that.
It's great. It's great. But here's the thing. So the Vulcan, she did save the day. And everybody really kind of acknowledges the fact that she did. And at the same time, she's being sent off the ship because of her actions, because she acted so un-Vulcan-like and, you know, followed hunches and followed her feelings and everything. And the captain's punishing her for doing that. And she tries to fight back on it because she's just like, in her own very quiet, not raising her voice way, she did what she did worked, and it saved the day, and it was the right thing to do, but she's still being punished for it.
And she cannot talk him out of it. I mean, again, it's one of those where she politely disagrees, and he refers to it as her outburst, which almost just seemed like that sort of thing where, you know, if a guy makes a complaint, he's making a complaint. If a woman makes a complaint, she's getting emotional, that kind of thing. Yeah. I have to wonder if that was kind of being hinted there. But she can't fight it. She's going to be sent to be working on a human ship. And I'm sure it's another one of those, well, you'll probably be more comfortable with them than you are with your own kind. And she walks out, and she gives, as she's walking away, not looking back, she gives the Vulcan salute. And she says, "Live long and prosper, sir." And I'm like, ooh, we just heard a Vulcan fuck you.
Oh, yeah, that was a big one. Yeah, seriously. Again, they establish it all throughout the episode that they don't raise their voices, they don't make a fuss and everything. So just that tiny little thing right there, it makes you go, ooh, she totally did that. Yep. Wow.
So that was great. And Boimler ends the episode regretting the fact that he's not going to be able to bond with anyone on the command crew. But then this younger ensign comes up and asks for Boimler, and he said Ransom told him that Boimler is one of the most organized people on the entire ship, so maybe he could help him out with his roster. And Boimler's like, okay, yeah. So it's just like, he ends up, I don't know if he's like, if he's like ends up the worst out of any of them because he didn't actually do anything to save the ship during the battle. But at the same time, he's like, okay, so somebody's looking up to him, which is good. Yeah, and he's good hearted. So he doesn't treat this person as like, oh, you're not worth my time because you're not the command crew. He's like, oh yeah, sure. Absolutely. And he finishes up by saying that the Lower Decks is where all of the action takes place on any ship. And then suddenly we flash to a Borg cube, and it gives the, you know, the Borg cube designation 20175, Lower Decks. And then you see four Borg that are in their like stasis chambers or whatever. And they're just sitting there, and the credits run as they're just sitting there and looking at all the little blinky lights flashing and nobody moving. I'm like, that is so clever.
They're so brilliant. Oh my God. It's just because people keep saying, oh yeah, we got to see three Lower Decks crews. Actually, we got to see four. So
technically we got to see five because we got to see the Packlets Lower Decks, but they were just
also true. Yes.
They were just sitting there, and one person said, I'm hungry. Other person said, you should eat. You are so smart. And the whole time the alarm's going, warm alarm, warm alarm. And of course the Borg ship, it made me wonder, who's the go-getter of the Borg Lower Decks crew, do you suppose? And what would that look like?
Oh, I have no idea. Oh, Lord.
I guess it looks pretty much just like that, what they showed us.
Yeah,
nobody
I think it
moving.
Does. Yeah, I'm sure there was stuff going on if we could speak Borg and knew there was probably all some sort of drama going on, but it just looked like little blinky lights to us. So I have no idea. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to talk about was, I got all the way through a rewatch of BoJack Horseman, which was wonderful, as always, except for the fact that I didn't, because I had started on the episode with the epic bender with Sarah Lynn in season three, so now I've started at the beginning of the season to work my way forward to that, and I got to an episode in season, I think it's in season one, where Charlotte, way back in the 80s, Charlotte is talking to BoJack Horseman at this party, and they're talking about the nature of fame and everything, right? Mm-hmm. And she says, she points to, they're standing out on a balcony at this party, and Charlotte points and says, look over there, see those tar pits? And she points to what's obviously the La Brea tar pits, except they're BoJack Horseman world. See those tar pits? Hollywood's a really pretty town that's smack on top of all that black tar. By the time you realize you're sinking, it's too late. And it's just, the thing is, in the very final episode when he's trying to get away from, I don't know, the door that is sucking him down, which is basically death, it's all black tar.
All
and
black
that's why
tar.
It looks like
oh
that.
Oh my goodness.
I was like, God, they set that up so far ahead of time. I didn't know. The show is so smart. I'm really enjoying it. I mean, it's just, I get the idea that I'm going to get to the episode that I started at with Sarah Lynn and probably keep watching, because it's just, it's, guys, if you haven't watched it, it's really good.
I remember somebody put together a supercut of all the times they use the word fuck, because the writers deliberately only wanted to use that, like when somebody was just at the end of their rope, usually with BoJack Horseman. And
that's right.
Wow, it's really, because I think that's what Charlotte tells him when, and you know, okay. So BoJack Horseman did not prey on Charlotte's daughter, but he did go out with her and all of their friends to prom and get one of them so drunk she had to be dropped off at the emergency room. And then her daughter, in a teenage frantic whatever, goes to BoJack's room because she thinks, well, obviously he must like her, so she's going to like convince him. And that's when Charlotte finds them. Did he do something awful? No, he did not. Would he have, is the question.
Yeah.
You think he would have if her mom hadn't come in?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, if I remember right, because I haven't seen that episode, I think it hadn't happened yet, but I think by the time Charlotte walked in, it was, I think it's pretty clear it would have. I think that's as far as, I want to say that he didn't have a shirt on and something, so I don't, you know, it's just like, It wasn't just her daughter doing it. I think BoJack would have done something.
Yeah, and none of that would have happened if he hadn't been inappropriate the entire time. So, and then you find out that's why his little sister ended up cutting him loose when she found out about all that. And it was just, it was one last thing that she could not tolerate from BoJack. And Todd told him at one point in this wonderful speech, is like, you can't keep doing awful things and then feeling bad about it. You need to be better. And that's something that took him so long to learn. It's just like, because he does bad things on impulse and he feels terrible about it. Nothing really changes.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's a lot of people think that as long as they apologize, then it's fine. You know, it's, hey, I did a bad thing, but I apologize. So now you have to forgive me. And you also can't give me a hard time about those things because I apologized. You're like, nope. That's why the whole episode with Herb Kazaz, which I watched, he went to Herb to apologize to him for, you know, basically stabbing him in the back in the day. And Herb's like, okay, I don't forgive you. And BoJack is flabbergasted. He's like, I don't think you understand what's happening here. I apologize. He's like, and I don't forgive you. I'm not going to be your vehicle to feel better about yourself. And it's like, it's very true.
It's very true. Yeah, I think someone did a demonstration in a classroom one time. It's making the rounds on the internet that you take a piece of paper and you crumple it up and then you tell it you're sorry and then you spread it out on the table. The wrinkles are still there. The apology does not make that not have happened.
Yeah, the other analogy I heard was they're talking about like a, I think it's kitsugumi, the bowl that breaks and then you repair it with gold. So it's still shows the flaws and it's, you know, but it's beautiful and everything. I had seen sometimes people say, hey, if you break a bowl and you apologize, the bowl is still broken. So, you know, apologies don't fix anything. And then some people respond with an image of the kitsugumi and said, yes, but, you know, you can put it back together and it becomes more beautiful and everything. I believe I heard someone say that, however, the bowl is not nearly as strong as it was. Yes, you have repaired the cracks and put it back together, but it's not the same bowl. And it is definitely apt to break again along those same lines. So I'm just like, oh, this metaphor gets more and more complex. I love it.
Well, the kitsugumi thing came up in an episode of BoJack Horseman where, what's her name? BoJack's assistant writer.
Diane.
Well, she was trying to work through trying to write a book about herself and trying to use all of the damage that she went through as something that she could turn into a positive by making a good book out of it. But it was just that one line. She's remembering Mr. Peanut Butter say, "It's like that bowl I gave you." "Yes." And Todd comes in and, "I broke the bowl." "Answer your phone." I don't know why that makes me laugh every time.
I love the animation style, and that was all like sketchy, cartoony and everything. They did such good things with all the animations. Just really great.
Yeah, and that was where Mr. Peanut Butter like fixed the bowl with kintsugi to make it prettier. And she said, "Yes." And then it fell apart, just like our marriage.
Wow, so smart. We could just go on forever. We have entire episodes devoted to BoJack Horseman. You guys can go look at them in our back catalog, because we have really analyzed the hell out of this show. But when I'm watching it, I can't stop talking about it. It's so
I think once I manage to get all the way through Arcane, I may try to give another rewatch of BoJack Horseman, or I might finally decide to watch Severance, because I've been meaning to do that.
Ooh, yeah, the second season has started and I haven't jumped into it yet because I'm scared. It's really heavy. It's extremely heavy. So I'm like, okay, oh, I got to get into it.
Well, speaking of heavy, I saw that the Oscar nominations have come out, and we can probably an entire episode talking about that, but I am very curious about The Substance. It's supposed to be kind of gross in places and maybe a little violent, but yeah, everybody's talking about it. It's a horror movie and it managed to get an Oscar nom. That's really says something.
Yeah. And also Demi Moore apparently was pretty amazing in it, and she hasn't done much lately, I suppose, but I saw her on an episode of Hot Wings. She wasn't fazed by those wings at all.
It does not surprise me.
Nope. Not even a bit. But I guess that will wrap us up for the week, so make sure to check out pixladygeek.com for all the book reviews, the movie reviews, the comic book reviews, the photo galleries. I just got the notice that, whew, we have been approved for 4 tickets, press passes, I should say, to WonderCon.
Good.
So we'll be attending that. That will be fun.
They waited until the very last second last year. I'm impressed that they were able to get that going this fast this time.
I'm wondering if they got complaints. I didn't complain, because these tickets are free, and so I'm like, hey, whenever you guys take your time, it's fine. So so we will definitely have all the pictures from that and all the other things that we attend, all that and more, pixladygeek.com. So we'll actually have Night Vale again next week.
We will, yes, or finally be back from hiatus.
Yes. Every time it happens, I'm like, I'm always surprised that it happens. And two, it just feels so much longer, because you sort of forget that we're not waiting a month for it to come back. We're waiting 6 weeks, because the last episode was halfway through December. So it's a long wait.
It's been a long time. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. So we'll talk about that, and I don't know, maybe Arcane, definitely Beastars, though. We will absolutely watch the Beastars.
Yeah, we need to talk about Beastars.
Yeah, we will. And one way or the other, we will talk to everybody in 1 week.
Talk to y'all later.
That's right.
I think we are going to need to start a new, we got less than a minute left. So let's end this one, and I'll send you an invite to the next one.
Sounds good. Okay.